Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Totally M. Since the last podcast, podcast 189, where we talked about COVID-19 in detail, I have been hearing more and more people are reaching out asking questions about COVID-19. It is a daily discussion in our society, at least for those who are working in healthcare settings or those who are impacted. But at this point, pretty much everyone in the United States is impacted in some way, whether it is a school closing or businesses that are needing to shut down, including restaurants, whatever the case may be, we are impacted in some way. So the question becomes, why is this and why do we need to have this happen? The biggest thing is going to be about social distancing, which we'll talk about more towards the end of this podcast. But the reason why is because of limited resources. Believe it or not, we have finite resources, and it really matters in times like this to do what's called flattening the curve. And this flattening the curve concept is because of what's going on with COVID-19, especially in the United States right now, where we're getting this exponential growth in the disease, meaning that more and more people every day are getting cases that are positive, and those who are symptomatic that are most likely positive with coronavirus, but because of limitations in testing and availability and so on, maybe they are not necessarily being tested for this disease, and we're limiting it to those who are higher risk. There's a variety of reasons why, and it's hard to really pinpoint down, but the key thing, what matters most, is the fact that this is growing rapidly in the United States as well as other parts of the world, and we need to take action before it's too late. I want to make this clear. This is not fear-mongering. I'm not trying to scare people, but I want people to realize that this has potential disastrous consequences. Yes, we may have made some jokes about the shortages of masks or hand sanitizers or now even toilet paper, but these shortages can mean so much more, not because of those types of resources per se, although bad, because they have their own implications with it, but this panic buying is just one example of it. Just imagine what it's like in the medical setting. You only have so many nurses, so many doctors, so many PAs and NPs and paramedics and EMTs and everyone else down the line. You only have so many individuals that work in the medical setting. And you only have so much personal protective equipment or PPE. You have only so many hospital beds, ventilators, and other life-saving equipment. Think about this for a second. What happens when we run out of that? And I actually want you to think even more, especially if you're working in a medical setting right now. How many beds are currently in your hospital? Do you have enough staff to support all those beds being full with patients? Here's an even better question. How many ICU beds do you have? How many ventilators do you have? How much of the other life-saving equipment that you need? How many CT scanners do you have? Do you realize that if a CT scanner is contaminated with COVID-19, how long it takes to decon that area? Some places are already using ultrasound machines and avoiding the use of chest x-ray even whenever possible, just because of the ease of decontaminating some of those devices compared to others, especially when you're talking about a CAT scanner, where now you can't take care of other patients who may need that care rapidly, such as those who are trauma patients or have major strokes or other acute pathology that's going on, where now that delay of imaging has significant impact on patient care. If you don't believe me, you don't really see where this is coming, I want to give you an example. I don't want to name any specific place. We're going to talk about Janus General Community Hospital. It's made up, and let's say it serves a community of 100,000 people. It has quite a few regular hospital beds, but most importantly, it has 25 critical care beds and only 10 ventilators in the hospital. That's not really surprising, given how most hospitals don't have enough ventilators for all their critical care beds. And you would be surprised at just how few mechanical ventilation devices are at any individual place at any one time. Now, that doesn't include, for example, maybe BiPAP, CPAP, high flow nasal cannula, stuff like that. But for our discussion, for this scenario, we're going to talk about this community hospital that serves 100,000 people, but they only have 25 critical care beds. Let's say they're all fully staffed in this scenario, although you might find many of your hospitals don't have full staffing for 25 beds, but we're going to say that they have 25 beds and 10 ventilators. Let's say in that 100,000 population, half the people get sick with COVID-19. given at least 80% or so, they're fine. They don't require hospitalization. They have a non-severe course of the disease and don't require any hospital stay. Okay, well, that leaves about 10,000 patients that need hospitalized. I guarantee you, Janus General, for 100,000 population, does not have 10,000 beds. They might have a couple of hundred if you're lucky. So we have a problem right there. But let's dive deeper into the people who, okay, now they really need to be hospitalized because they need intensive care. Okay, well, based on data from hospitalized patients that we have, 10 to 20% of those admitted require ICU care. That's 1,000 to 2,000 patients in that 100,000 population. Okay, so about 1 to 2% of all people might require intensive care. Doesn't sound terrible, right? That's still a lot of people. Remember, we're dealing with 25 beds, so hold on to that for just a second. Let's go to the next part of this. 3 to 10% of those admitted, so out of that 10,000 people, 3 to 10% of them will require intubation. So that's a total of 300 to 1,000 patients. A big range, I know, but something to keep in mind. Because again, there's only 10 ventilators. 2 to 5% of all those admitted will die. So 200 to 500 people out of that 100,000 dies. That's where people are like, okay, well, maybe it's not so bad. And there's truth to that. Maybe it's not as bad as the fatality rate goes. But think about the number of people who need critical care beds or need other life-saving management, including intubation and mechanical ventilation. Based on the same data, non-severe patients, the length of stay in the hospital was 11 days on average, and severe patients, the length of stay was 13 days. So almost 2 weeks, these patients on average will stay, and given some are going to stay longer and some are shorter. So as we're seeing this exponential growth curve, remember that the resources are limited and they will run out quickly in this situation. And it's hard to maybe sometimes grasp this concept. So I included what I found was a clever way of helping describe this from the Washington Post, where they show a series of graphics and kind of compare each scenario. I would recommend you check that out. It's a great teaching tool for people who may not understand why quarantine versus isolation versus other methods work. So let's go back to our Janus General Community Hospital and the outbreak that they are experiencing. Okay, if we spread this out over the course of months, this hospital will still be overwhelmed. But let's go with the conservative estimates here. Let's say that you only need critical care beds for a week at a time, and that there are 25 of these beds fully staffed, ready to go. Okay, so even with 1,000 patients for 25 critical care beds, you'll need to spread this out over 40 weeks to assume that these patients will not have a place where they won't be able to go, meaning that there will always be an ICU bed available for that patient. We'd have to spread this disease out by over 40 weeks on the ideal side. Given at the exponential growth, this can occur in a course of weeks rather than months. And those 25 beds that are being consumed by these patients do not go to other patients, because you have to keep in mind that patients who require critical care include sepsis from other causes, major heart attacks and strokes, trauma, and so many other conditions. So now you have an issue where you still have ICU beds. Let's say on average they're using maybe 10 to 15 of their ICU beds, maybe 20 of their ICU beds, but they're usually not at maximum capacity. And when they are, what happens? They transport them to a different hospital where they may have more beds available, because usually not everyone's hit at once with this. But for a pandemic disease like COVID-19, you don't run into that scenario where you just get to dish it off to the next town and hope that they have the resources and the abilities to take care of this. Everyone gets overwhelmed. And when you have an exponential growth in this, everyone gets overwhelmed to the point where you can no longer take care of patients the way you need to. And this is where it becomes dangerous. This is where people die. It's not because of the fact that people die simply from the disease, although it happens. But where they really run into risk is that if you have that 1,000 people that need ICU care, but only 25 beds, what happens to the other 975 people that need that bed? Even if you spread it over a few weeks, there's still a couple of hundred people who need 25 beds every week. This is dangerous. This gets bad quickly. This is why we have to be proactive. And again, I'm not trying to scare people, but I want people to understand, because I get asked so often, why do we need to be worried about this? And this is why. It's because of the ability to rapidly spread in a population. And this is what has me concerned, because yes, many of us will be fine. Again, you've got 40,000 people in that 100,000 community who, even when they contract it, they're going to be going home. They're going to have mild symptoms at best, but it impacts the economy when you have such a large number, and more importantly, it impacts patient health. So we have to flatten this curve. And how do we do that? A big part of that is going to be social distancing. That way, our resources, while limited and most likely will still be overwhelmed to a degree, will not be as overwhelmed as what we will experience otherwise. So what can we do about this? Well, again, we're trying to prevent as many deaths as possible. And this is an ethical nightmare that some of us may know as utilitarianism. And if you're trying to remember what utilitarianism is, then think about the train track scenario. You may have heard of this before. A train is out of control. It has two tracks it can go down. One has 10 people stuck on the tracks. Another one has one person stuck on the tracks. Which way are you going to go? And the idea is that you have no scenario out of this. You cannot stop the train. You have to hit either 10 people or just that one person. And this is where we have to think about things. Unfortunately, this is a real scenario for us. We have to be the ones to decide, as a society, are we going to max out and not do the conservative measures to help flatten that curve? Or are we going to take social responsibility and take care of the populace as a whole? So, flattening the curve, how do we do this? Well, a lot of it's already happening. Closing of schools, restaurants, beaches, and other public places, canceling conferences. Other things are coming up where the common goal is, again, to promote social distancing. And you may be asking yourselves, well, what is social distancing? It's the idea of avoiding close contact with other individuals. And this is being used by public health officials for other types of diseases too. But the idea is to help stop or at least slow down the spread of disease. And while quarantine may work, it relies on prompt identification and containment. When you think about the number of cases that are showing up in the United States, it's probably greatly underestimated because of the number of people who are sick who have not been tested. I personally know people who've reached out with symptoms and a very high likelihood of having the disease, but no way to get tested. So what do they do? Well, they're just told to stay at home. And if their symptoms get worse, to go to the hospital. But they most likely have COVID-19, but it doesn't get tested. And again, to me, that speaks a lot, because now we have more cases than we're actually contributing. And what can sound like a not so scary situation is actually much more intense than what we believe if we just pay attention to the numbers that we see through the CDC and other public health agencies. So the quarantine also has to work by being able to quarantine patients who are asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic. But the problem is, if you don't have enough testing and can't track down all the leads, those people inevitably, usually not intentionally, go to other places and they spread it. So if we still have large gatherings, if we still have a lot of ways to help promote person-to-person interactions, then we're going to allow more spread of the disease. This is why this matters so much. So again, what do? We promote social distancing. How do we do it? Well, if we won't do it individually, then organizations and hopefully in some ways the government can help promote this. Again, by closing down certain things such as schools, promoting distance learning, and promoting working from home, and other types of things that can help contain those who are infected and help protect and avoid the spread to uninfected individuals. Like I said, we may not have the perfect scenario. We may not have a complete 100% stop of COVID-19, but if we can at least slow this down enough to avoid overwhelming the resources that we have, this is where we will save lives. I do want to point out something though, because I am impressed and I am very excited and very happy for the amount of individual and small group involvement, including small businesses that have taken the initiative to do things to help protect their employees and their customers. So I commend that. And like others in the medical community who realize there's no way of us getting out of this, we are going to be exposed. We're going to be on the front lines. Like, I take that for what it is. And I'm going to work hard to keep myself and my family and my loved ones and everyone else that I care for and my patients safe. That doesn't change. But what does change, and what I think we need to take away from this, is why don't we do this more often? Why can't we take care of this more? Think about every year with flu. It spreads rampantly, and we kind of let it happen. But in this case, we're doing more. And I understand, again, the severity is worse with COVID-19 compared to influenza. But also, think about some social issues here. Sometimes, you know, you have these organizations who say that they can't accommodate those with special needs, with disabilities, and yet now we're doing this for the whole population. I think this speaks a lot to a lot of different issues that I think is worth its own podcast a different time to talk about this more. But I will leave you with that thought of this is important. This is something that we could do more often if we need to. But right now, with COVID-19, we need to do this. So please, if you don't understand, hopefully you do now. If I need to clarify anything further, I am happy to do so. Please reach out with your questions, thoughts. What I want to know is that we can help with this and that you can be a part of this. If you are looking for more resources, check out the CDC, the WHO, and there are some really good online resources that come from individuals or small groups. My favorite is the Internet Book of Critical Care, because they are constantly evolving and updating this segment because they realize how important it is and how much they contribute to this. At least I hope they understand how much they're contributing to this. So make sure to check them out. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.